and his body heat began to warm his little cocoon. She would be here soon. It was after the ball. What would he say to her? So she had succumbed to his charms after all. And that strange, withering look she had given him after the incident with Peterson had belied a hidden affection. She had understood what was in his heart all along. And now she was on her way. He fought sleep, waiting and waiting. Before long, it was morning. When he awoke, he found himself staring into the eyes of the most colorful bird he'd ever seen. It was a rooster with brilliant plumage of blue and red and golden feathers, and it came at him with beating wings and talons extended. Alex barely made it out of the loft with his eyes intact. More than 2 years later. 8. Reconnaissance. Deserted Road, rural New Jersey, February 1780. The deeply rutted road was frozen, aggravating the bumpy pace of Eliza's wooden-wheeled carriage. With every detour the coachman took, she bounced up and hit her head on the low roof, landing in her seat with her bonnet knocked askew. She tightened the ribbon strings for what felt like the 20th time. After 6 hours of this, she didn't even consider tucking in the loose wisps of her hair. Instead, she pulled aside the window's heavy curtain and looked out over the snow-covered fields glittering in the late afternoon sun. Her seat faced backward, so she could only see where she'd been, not where she was going. Here and there a farmhouse sat in a cluster of smaller worksheds, but these were few and far between. Morristown, New Jersey, her destination, was a city of several thousand inhabitants, but so far there was no sign of any kind of life.
"Miss Schuyler, please!"
her chaperone, Mrs. Jansen, cried, a nervous woman who always seemed to be huffing at something.
"You are letting out all the heat."
If only I could, Eliza thought. The temperature inside the carriage was akin to a hot stove. But worse than the heat was the smell. Squared away behind Mrs. Jansen was a supply of lamp oil and scrimshaw, gifts sent along to General Washington from her husband, an Albany merchant who specialized in whale products. The collection was rounded out by the good lady's personal bottle of whale oil perfume, a cloying scent she had grown overly fond of. She rubbed it on her skin the way other women used soap. Eliza took a deep breath, then let the curtain fall. "If I don't get out of here soon, I'll be stinking of whale oil myself." She turned to her chaperone with a sigh. "How much farther is it to Morristown?" Mrs. Jansen rolled her eyes and huffed once more. She reached into the folds of the fur spread over her lap and pulled out an imaginary map, unfolding it with theatrical fastidiousness.
Let me see. "Yes, here we are," she said, stabbing a gloved finger into thin air. "It is exactly 17 miles and 3 feet.
Mrs. Jansen pressed her lips together just so, tucking the imaginary map back into her blanket. Eliza fell silent. Her mother was to have accompanied her on the trip south, but Mrs. Schuyler had fallen ill with a violent cough, serious enough to make it unwise for her to travel. Eliza was willing to make the trip on her own, but her mother wouldn't hear of the notion of a girl her age making a journey without a chaperone. The roads are overrun with soldiers too long denied women's taming influence, she said from her bed, propped up by pillows and swaddled in down.
But Mama, Eliza insisted, I can take care of myself.
Mrs. Schuyler waved her handkerchief in the air, ending the discussion.
I'll not have my daughter be the first feminine face they see in who knows how long. Eliza wasn't convinced the presence of Mrs. Jansen would safeguard her. But if that's what it took to make this trip, then she was willing to bear it. Perhaps her mother had realized her chaperone's abominable perfume was weapon enough against a soldier's advance. She stifled a laugh and smiled to herself. The fragrant Mrs. Jansen tightened the fur pelt around her knees. "I beg your pardon, Miss Schuyler. Did you just say something?" "Oh, why, yes. I was just wondering whether you had ever met my Aunt Gertrude." Eliza hid her smile behind her hand. "Yes, that's it. Her that married Dr. Cochrane, General Washington's personal physician. She is sister to your father, is she not? I can't say that I've had the pleasure of making her acquaintance, but I have heard the kindest things about her character." Mrs. Jansen, an accomplished gossip, mumbled to herself, "Imagine the stories she's privy to, surrounded by all those soldiers and whatnot." "Indeed, she is a remarkable woman and a great inspiration to me. Aunt Gertrude insisted her husband train her in the ways of a nurse so that she could remain at his side to assist in the recuperation of our brave patriots." Mrs. Jansen's pinched face took on a saintly look. "Just as I have spent many a day swabbing the sweat from the brow of a feverish soldier, and suffocating those poor invalids with your ghastly perfume," Eliza supposed. Aloud, she said, "But my Aunt Gertrude does so much more. She washes the blood from wounds and runs the threaded needle through lacerated limbs as calmly as stitching together a torn overshirt. Why, she's even held the hand of a soldier while Dr. Cochrane saws off the other—" "Miss Schuyler, if you please." Mrs. Jansen held up a gloved hand. "I do not consider such subjects fit conversation for a lady." Eliza smiled a tepid apology. Of course the details were gruesome, yet she found them fascinating. It was bad enough that women weren't allowed to fight for their freedom, but to be denied the knowledge of what fighting cost its soldiers seemed too much to bear. How could one help the country's bravest young men if their needs were kept silent? The carriage hit another pockmark in the road, sending Mrs. Jansen's bottle of whale oil perfume sliding across the coach floor.
"Begging your pardon yet again, ladies,"
hollered Mr. Vincent from the coach box. The coachman was one of General Schuyler's retired old soldiers, now employed as the trusted family driver.
"It's a bit of a rough go out here."
Eliza reached down and caught the bottle, which leaked onto her hands. But by the time Mrs. Jansen could tighten the lid and settle the bottle more securely under her seat, a fresh wave of whale oil perfume had filled the coach. Aching to be done with this journey, Eliza decided to look on the bright side. "Well, at least there will be no fighting this winter while the army shelters in Morristown. Aunt Gertrude will be working alongside Dr. Cochrane, inoculating the local population against smallpox. I believe it is heroic work."
"Very elation," Mrs. Jansen said, sneering. "Tell me why anyone would think that infecting someone with pestilence ought cause but further disease."
"It's a milder form that's used for inoculation." Eliza slowed her words as if talking to a child. "The scratch method is much safer. Look at how many of our soldiers have stayed healthy."
Mrs. Jansen huffed once again.
"If God had wanted his subjects to resist the pox, he would have made us so."
Eliza thought about saying that if God had not wanted his subjects to be so creative, perhaps he should have made them less ingenious. But she held her tongue. A little blasphemy would likely induce a faint in the good Mrs. Jansen, and the thought of having to fan her awake and send fresh clouds of perfume through the coach was not to be borne. Instead, Eliza abandoned the conversation and peeked through a slit in the heavy curtain.
Aunt Gertrude had written the family 2 months ago with news of Dr. Cochrane's plans to continue the inoculations while General Washington's army wintered at Morristown. She had called it work of the gravest importance, as military hospitals were overrun with soldiers confined in crowded wards that were breeding grounds for disease. "Inoculation," she wrote with palpable hope, "could save hundreds, if not thousands, of lives." Eliza wanted desperately to be a part of the mission. She'd fired off a letter to her aunt to ask if she could help give the inoculations herself. If she could not fight, she could at least do everything in her power to make sure that those who did fight were as well equipped as possible. There were far fewer troops in the Albany area than there were farther south, of course, but they were vital to the capital's security. Thanks in part to Eliza's efforts, the battalions were all kitted out in smart new uniforms, stuffed with beef and porridge, and housed in some of the most comfortable mansions in the area, which had been seized from British loyalists. Inoculation seemed like the last noble service she could offer them. She had begged her mother to let her make the journey south. Surely old Vincent was up to the task. Mrs. Schuyler had refused at first, saying it was far too dangerous. But Eliza had pleaded. She reminded her mother General Washington himself was spending the winter in Morristown, along with his senior staff and thousands of his troops. There was no safer place on the continent. The mention of General Washington had not endeared Eliza's plan to Mrs. Schuyler. General Schuyler's court-martial was only recently completed, and even though he'd been exonerated of all wrongdoing in the Battle of Ticonderoga, she still felt that the military trial ought not to have taken place at all. Indeed, General Washington had gone so far as to write General Schuyler a letter of congratulations on his acquittal. But Mrs. Schuyler was unmoved. She was a steady woman and slow to ire. But once one had earned her wrath, her forgiveness was hard to come by. Almost as an afterthought, Mrs. Schuyler had warned Eliza, "I suppose that foul Colonel Hamilton will be there as well." Colonel Hamilton had served as clerk to the prosecution during the trial. He had been studying to be a lawyer before the war broke out, and though he had left school to serve the Revolution, he was still competent enough in the ways of the law and the military that he had been called upon to liaise between the court and General Washington's office. It was yet another honor for one so young, but clerking for the prosecutor had supposedly caused him great pain, given his regard for the Schuyler family and his belief in General Schuyler's innocence. He had written as much in a letter to General Schuyler, but Eliza's father insisted on his presence. If General Washington was not going to preside over the farce of a trial, then he wanted someone close to the commander-in-chief to attend, so that Washington would be fully apprised of all that had gone on and would feel that much more shame at capitulating to the political whims of the Congress. Eliza thought to remind her mother of all this, then decided against it. Not that Eliza had given any thought to Colonel Hamilton's presence in Morristown, nor did she have any opinion as to the high level of his intelligence. Not at all. Besides, recalling the past would only cause Mrs. Schuyler to get her back up. But to her surprise, her mother had relented rather quickly. She saw the silver lining in Eliza's plan. "There will be any number of unmarried officers in Morristown. Perhaps you will meet a suitable bachelor to replace the one who courted you so diligently and turned away." Her mother was talking about Major John Andre, the British officer who had strived to win her hand. Eliza had been a bit infatuated with him for a while, but in the end had turned down his suit. Perhaps she was too much of a patriot to accept the man, unlike Angelica, who was holding steady with her Mr. Church, despite his having left her and the country without proposing. Almost 3 years after her illustrious ball, Mrs. Schuyler was irritated to find her three oldest daughters still unmarried, and mentioned this unfortunate state of affairs often. "Oh, Mama," Eliza said, running off to pack. Eliza pulled back the curtain again and peered out. She felt Mrs. Jensen's glare and ignored it. The snowy fields and barren trees looked no different from those of 10 minutes earlier, and soon enough she let the curtain drop of her own accord. "I wonder how much farther," she couldn't help but say aloud. Mrs. Jensen opened her mouth for a retort, but was caught up by a jarring thump, followed by an even louder crack. "Whoa!" came the faint voice of the coachman. "Whoa there!" The carriage lurched to a stop, and then slowly, with a splintering sound as of a branch breaking off a tree, the right rear of the compartment sank slowly, heavily down, until it was some 3 feet lower than the left. Eliza had to grip both sides of the carriage to keep from falling upon Mrs. Jensen, who was lying on her back, her legs sticking straight up in the air and protruding from the ruffled yardage of her petticoats and bloomers. "What on earth?" Mrs. Jensen exclaimed, desperately trying to right herself, but having little more success than a turtle flipped on its shell. Eliza couldn't decide which was the more frightening prospect, falling on Mrs. Jensen or being shrouded in that terrible perfume, but she wasn't about to find out. She towed the older lady's skirts aside as delicately as she could, spread her feet, and braced them against the opposite seat. "Driver!" she called out. "Driver! There seems to have been some kind of tilt!" The left-hand door of the carriage flew open, and the bearded face of Mr. Vincent appeared. "Beggin' your pardon, my ladies," he called out in his thick Irish brogue. "I'm afraid we've broken a wheel. Allow me." He reached a meaty hand into the carriage, wrapped it around Eliza's arm, and pulled her from the skewed compartment with no more effort than if she'd been a weaning puppy. The left side of the carriage was some 5 feet above the ground, and once free of the narrow door, Eliza had no choice but to jump down. The road was frozen hard as stone, and sharp hot pains pierced her feet as she landed. Convinced her daughter was likely to meet eligible bachelors along the trip, Mrs. Schuyler had insisted she wear fancy shoes of thin embroidered cotton, hardly proof against a New Jersey winter. The shoe heels were a full inch tall. Their thin soles gave way almost immediately to the chill of the frozen roadway. She shook her feet to warm them, looking up just as the coachman lowered himself into the carriage to help Mrs. Jensen. Eliza had once seen a pair of fighting squirrels chase each other into a pumpkin that had been hollowed out to hold a candle. The pumpkin had shook like a kettle on the boil as the animals tore at each other inside its orange shell, until suddenly the top burst off, and one of the squirrels flew into the air and dashed off, leaving the other one poking from the cracked gourd. As the coachman attempted to free Mrs. Jensen, the tilted carriage vibrated with nearly the same violence as that long-ago pumpkin. The stranded lady's yelps and squeaks pierced the otherwise silent afternoon. Interrupted by the coachman's half-desperate requests, "If you would just hold still, my lady. Beg pardon, my lady. But if you want to be liberated, you will have to allow me to place my hand just there." "Well, I'm sorry, dearie, but I thought that was just swaddling." Popping like a bubble, Mrs. Jensen was fully ejected from the open door and rolled over and off the side of the carriage. Eliza rushed forward to help, only to be thrown aside by the bulk of the older woman's skirts as she sprawled onto the ground. "My ankle!" the older lady screamed in pain. "It's broken!" The coachman appeared, and despite his ample build, jumped nimbly to the ground. "Forgive me again, my lady," he said, unceremoniously hefting her skirt and reaching for her ankle.
"Sir," Mrs. Jansen protested, "I must remind you that I am a married woman and a lady."
The coachman ignored her. His nimble fingers slipped inside her booted ankle and squeezed tenderly. Mrs. Jansen winced and pulled away, but he held her in place.
"It's not broken. Probably just a sprain. Best keep the boot on to hold in the swelling. We're only 5 miles from Morristown, but this does complicate things."
"Complicate things? I shall, in all likelihood, lose my leg."
Eliza couldn't resist. "My Uncle John is an excellent physician, and I shall be honored to hold your hand while he cuts."
"Now, now, ladies, let's not get carried away,"
Mr. Vincent said, though he grinned at Eliza out of view of Mrs. Jansen. He looked over at the ruined coach wheel. It was thoroughly shattered.
"No fixing that. I'm afraid we'll have to ride."
"But there are only 2 horses, Mrs. Jansen protested, "and no saddles, and we ladies in skirts."
"Aye, there's that."
He pondered a moment.
"This will require some rope."
A half hour later, Mrs. Jansen lay awkwardly across one of the horses, tied onto it like a saddlebag and covered in a voluminous fur, so that she looked like a bear carcass being brought in from a hunt.
"This is most indecorous," she said. "I assure you that you will not be receiving a tip at the end of this journey."
The coachman ignored her and turned to Eliza.
"Mrs. Jensen's ankle is starting to swell up like a puff adder. I'm afraid of proving her right in her fear of amputation if we don't get to a doctor in short order. I was going to put you on the second horse and lead you, but I really do think we need to ride."
Although she had wrapped herself in the other fur from the carriage, Eliza had no protection from the winter other than her waistcoat. Her feet, however, were freezing and starting to go numb.
"Of course," Eliza said. "I would not wish further injury to Mrs. Jansen, but with no saddle, sir, and me encompassed by all this fabric,"
she indicated the expanse of her dress, "I do not think we shall both fit, or that I shall be able to remain astride."
"I shouldn't blame your dress, milady, as much as my own belly."
He patted his large stomach.
"The wife's shepherd pie is too tasty for my own good, I'm afraid. Well, I am at a bit of a loss, I must admit."
"It is only 5 miles to Morristown, you say. Mr. Vincent, you've known me to walk that kind of distance on a daily basis back home in Albany. Why don't you ride with Mrs. Jansen to aid, and I shall come on foot?"
"Your self-sacrifice is admirable, milady, but I can see how ill-shod you are for such a journey."
"Nonsense. We Dutch girls rarely even bother with shoes on a day as warm as this."
"She's fine, coachman," Mrs. Jansen called. "Do please let's hurry. I'm dying."
The coachman shook his head anxiously.
"Night's coming on, too, and the moon's waning crescent. One step off the road, and I fear it'll be you who meets her end on this day."
Eliza could see no other solution, and wished the coachman would get going with things. The sooner she started walking, the sooner she would reach her destination. Before she could speak again, however, she heard the clip-clop of horse hooves from farther down the road.
"Is it Redcoats?" Mrs. Jansen moaned. "We are killed!"
The British had been confined to the eastern shore of the Hudson River in New York City. But even so, Eliza was tense as she turned on her aching feet and stepped from behind the broken carriage to see who was approaching. A large bay horse was galloping toward them, mounted by a figure in tricorn and dark blue overcoat.
"Never fear," she said to Mrs. Jansen. "It is one of ours."
The soldier's face was obscured by a scarf, Eliza saw as he approached, no doubt to protect it from the cold. She wouldn't have minded one herself. The rider was not tall,
but certainly not short, with broad shoulders and a perfect martial posture, wearing a long, slightly curved sword at his waist. The only part of his face that was visible, however, was a pair of piercing blue eyes staring at her, almost, she could have sworn, with amusement. A voice came through the scarf with a fog of breath.
"Looks like we've had an accident."
The mirth was audible in the words as well as visible in the eyes.
"Sorry to say we have," the coachman replied. "And our precious Mrs. Jensen has injured her ankle. I wonder if perhaps you could give our Mrs. Schuyler the use of your horse?"
"Oh, I'd be happy to give the daughter of General Schuyler a lift," the scarved figure answered. "That is, if Eliza does not object."
The soldier pulled back his scarf then, revealing a shadow of reddish stubble. Eliza's hand flew to her mouth. It was Colonel Alexander Hamilton. 9. Knight in Shining Armor. Not-so-deserted road, rural New Jersey, February, 1780.
"Slow there, Hector."
Alex inched the big bay closer to the three stranded travelers, bringing him to a precise halt with his nose against his chest. Swinging both legs over his saddle, he landed before them in an elegant dismount.
"The sun will be down soon. We should make haste."
He dropped to one knee next to Eliza and laced the fingers of his gloved hands together to offer a lift up onto Hector's back.
"A leg up, m'lady."
An unmistakable quiver of embarrassment and annoyance ran through her, but indeed the sun had already dropped behind the trees and darkness was fast setting in. In spite of the frozen cold ground under her delicate cloth shoes, it appeared her wounded pride was enough to make her lift her chin and press on. As nimbly as she could, Eliza set her feet in the cradle of his sturdy hands in order to allow herself to be hoisted into place. She placed one hand on his shoulder and reached for the saddle pommel with the other as their bodies passed in close proximity. Calculating the full weight of her body, Alex inhaled the edge of her bonnet and found himself caught off guard by a vague whiff of what could only be whale oil. Eliza settled herself with as much dignity as she could muster, both legs to one side of the cavalryman's saddle. Gathering up the reins, she clutched at some wisp of control. She looked down into the faces of the two men staring up at her, and addressed them through a clenched jaw. "Now, sirs, I must ask you to kindly turn your backs while I take a moment to, arrange myself," said Eliza. "I'm afraid there's nothing else for it."
"It's a pity, but I agree," said the young colonel,
although he didn't sound at all disappointed. The two men pivoted 180 degrees in perfect tandem. The red-faced coachman pulled off his cap and stared straight down into it, a signal he planned to wait as long as this might take. Still strapped across the coachman's horse like a duffel bag, Mrs. Jansen swiveled her head to survey the scene. To her right, two men stood staring off into the sunset with their backs to her ward. To her left, General Schuyler's devoted daughter Eliza was busy hiking her skirts up to her waist, all the while perched atop a 16-hand gelding.
"Lord have mercy upon us all," wailed the incapacitated chaperone. "This must surely be the devil's doing."
Eliza thought she glimpsed a slight shaking of the much too obliging Colonel Hamilton's shoulders. And yet, she had real work to do. She raised her skirts and opened her knees wide enough to swing her right leg across the saddle. "There." Eliza had grown up riding the fields alongside her father and always felt most in charge on the back of a horse. Sitting astride, Eliza leaned forward into the saddle's polished leather, which was disconcertingly warm.
She certainly fit, but the problem was the dress. Between skirt, underskirt, petticoat, slip, and ankle-length form-fitting pantaloons, which were new in style and considered a bit French and risqué, there was too much fabric for her to ride side-saddle or otherwise. Her dress ballooned in front of her, spilling out around the horse's neck, spooking him in the early evening light, and making it impossible to grasp the reins as well. Behind her rose a mountain of petticoats and skirts, leaving no room for a second figure in the saddle.
"Well, then," said Eliza. "I'll need another moment, please, gentlemen."
She slid down from the saddle, aware of the cold ground under her silly shoes, and taking her skirts in her hands, ripped them apart clear up to her knees. But she wasn't done. Grasping the paler petticoat and underskirt in her hands, she tore them until her legs were covered only by pantaloons and hose. Apoplectic at the rending of the garments, the halfway upside-down Mrs. Jansen hollered out from the back of her horse.
"Do speak up, Miss Schuyler! Is your honor in danger? Say the word, and I shall set these ruffians to rights."
"Never fear, madam, all is well," Alex called over his shoulder. "Miss Schuyler's dress has merely become a bit entangled, and she has freed it from its, entanglements."
"Don't presume to speak to me as if I were a spinster ill-versed in the ways of the world, young man. Next thing you know, she'll be wearing a sackcloth."
Eliza heard the unforgivable laughter in the young colonel's voice, and her blood started to boil.
"Mrs. Jansen, let me assure you I am in full control of my well-being now, as well as in the foreseeable future."
Looking every bit the rag doll, Eliza pulled her waistcoat in close for warmth. As she stretched her spine to her full height, a twinkling of vanity flashed through her mind. In 5 miles, she would arrive at the army's winter quarters as a victim of her mother's fashion sense. With her bonnet ribbons bouncing around her head, she stuck her left foot in the stirrup and hoisted herself back on Hector. Her legs dangled straight down alongside the leathers, heels down and toes up like the experienced rider she was.
"Sirs, you may now return me your gaze."
The two men turned her way slowly, neither wishing to be the first set of fresh eyes.
"Crikey!"
gurgled the coachman. The stunned Irishman buried his face in his hands.
"Oh, miss, please, forgive me. I am quite amazed."
Alex couldn't resist a smile, nor could he pretend that he wasn't above finding a certain amount of guilty pleasure at the sight of the general's daughter perched atop his wary steed in a much shorter dress than any girl has ever worn in public.
"Well then, coachman, we must all be on our way before the frigid night air sets in. Miss Schuyler and I shall push on at a faster pace than you, due to Mrs. Jansen's unfortunate condition. We will ride ahead and send back a flatbed wagon and blankets for a more comfortable and, shall we say, dignified arrival for such a brave lady."
The coachman squinted at the brave lady's rump.
"Yes, sir," he said, yanking his cap down over his eyebrows. "It's sure to be slow going on this end." "Yes, slow indeed."
Alex turned to a shivering Eliza, who was staring resolutely in the opposite direction, pretending not to notice how little she was wearing. He spotted the extra fur blanket on the ground where Eliza had let it fall and handed it up to her.
"Now then, miss, if you will permit me to come aboard."
Eliza gave him the slightest nod.
"You may, if you must."
It took a single heartbeat for Alex to maneuver himself onto the horse, declaring the space behind the saddle his own. His legs slid beneath Eliza's ripped skirts, pressing against them. Reaching for the reins, his arms surrounded her, but he felt her body stiffen as she shrugged him off.
"I am perfectly capable of directing Hector, Colonel Hamilton. If you will let me see to the reins, then you can offer the spurs in a proper way.
Indeed, my lady, Alex said, handing over the reins.
Then, with a firm kick to the horse's withers, he started Hector up with a force that jerked Eliza's head back against the young officer's chest. Again, he imagined he smelled the vaguest hint of whale oil.
Whale oil?
And could it be that for once he found it sweet-smelling, if only because she was wearing it? They rode on for some minutes without speaking.
He doesn't know, Eliza realized. This conceited officer doesn't believe I know how to ride.
And yet, the partnership between Eliza and Hector had already begun, as she held the reins like they were tiny birds, directing the bit gently inside Hector's mouth. She watched his ears fall forward into the way of a contented horse. Meanwhile, the young officer behind her was having some trouble maintaining his seat. Having neither stirrups nor reins to hold, he bounced on the horse's croup like a rowboat tossed by waves.
"Pardon me, Miss Schuyler," he said hesitantly. "But could you kindly keep Hector to a walk? Forgive me, but I'm afraid I absolutely must."
Suddenly, his hands came to rest on Eliza's waist. Eliza started, but didn't speak. Instead, she slapped the reins against Hector's neck, sending him into a sudden trot. Alex's quick reflexes were all that kept him on Hector, that in his hands now gripping the saddle's edge for all they were worth.
"Easy, boy. That'll do."
Eliza tightened the reins to bring the horse to an abrupt halt. She turned her chin toward Alex.
"Sir, you may place your hands around my waist, but only with my prior consent. Is that clear?"
"As clear as the night air, Miss Schuyler, and every bit as cold."
Eliza couldn't help but smile at that.
"Then may I assume I now have Mrs. permission to remain comfortably attached to the back of this saddle, even though it involves some slight contribution on her part?" he asked.
Eliza lifted her chin. It felt fine to be in control again.
"You may, sir, and I trust that to mean we will continue our journey with no further breach of decorum. Agreed?"
"You shall have no protest from me, miss."
They rode on in silence once more, with the colonel settled into position with his legs narrowly touching Eliza's and his hands surrounding her ribcage like a belt. The winter sun was well below the tree line now. Hector stumbled on a root growth along the dark, rutted roadway. Alex instinctively tightened his grip on Eliza's waist, and was surprised when she didn't seem to mind. The softness of her back revealed she wore no corset, no doubt because she was traveling. But until now, her posture was as unyielding beneath his fingers as if she were all laced up. Her shallow breaths barely disturbed her rib cage, and he'd found himself inhaling deeply, breathing against the back of her neck as if to lend her the warm air from his own lungs. Now he noticed how her shoulders had dropped some of their previous tension. Something about her poise in the saddle reminded him of how she held herself on the dance floor.
"I must say, Miss Schuyler," he began, "I have nothing but fond memories of your family from the time of my last visit."
"A visit? Is that what you're calling it? It felt more like an ambush."
"Miss Schuyler, I want you to know that my official relationship with your father in no way mirrors my personal feelings toward him. Indeed, I have only the greatest level of respect for him. I do apologize for having been the bearer of bad news that evening, and for my strong words about Ticonderoga. And I hope you will accept a belated apology for my repeated offenses against your father's good name the night we last met."
"Do go on, sir."
"I take you into my utmost confidence when I tell you that none other than General Washington himself
believed your father to have been a patriot during the fall of Fort Ticonderoga. Indeed, he praised the way the troops defended themselves, greatly outnumbered as they were. It is to your father's everlasting credit that he refused to let the blame rest on any shoulders but his own.
For all the praise you heap on my father, you had a fine way of showing it then. Prosecuting him in a court-martial for dereliction of duty, she retorted.
I assure you that if there had been any way to avoid the embarrassment of the trial, I would have.
If you feel that way, then why did you pursue the matter? Let me guess, you were only following orders.
But I was, Alex replied. Your father's.
If you expect me to believe that my father insisted on his own trial, you take me for a fool.
But it's true, Alex insisted. I thought you knew. Your father did not want the slightest shadow of doubt hanging over his actions concerning the Ticonderoga battle. He refused to accept the resolution of censure offered by the Continental Congress, and insisted on a full trial instead, where he was convinced he would be exonerated, as indeed he was.
But why would Papa not tell his own family this?
I cannot say. Perhaps he thought to spare you the ugly details of politics, or did not want his own family to think ill of the government to which he has dedicated his life.
So you did not want to prosecute him? You thought him blameless in the fall of Ticonderoga? She asked.
Not just blameless, but exceptionally far-sighted. If your father had not instituted the measures he put in place, not only Ticonderoga would have fallen, but all of New England.
You know we lost our house and farm at Saratoga, Eliza said with injured pride. General Burgoyne burned it all to the ground.
I am aware of that. Aware, too, that your father, out of a font of gentlemanly generosity, allowed that same General Burgoyne to shelter at your house after he was defeated.
A heavy sigh from Eliza gave Alex a little hope that she might be warming up, finally. Yes, he surrendered his own marriage bed to the general for well over a month. And I must say, Mama found that to be a bit too generous. Eliza sniffed at the memory of it all. She and Papa were forced to sleep in one of the guest rooms. Alex murmured absent-mindedly.
I am sure it was more comfortable than the hayloft.
I beg your pardon?
Eliza's posture went suddenly rigid.
Alex didn't answer, and once again they rode in silence. When it seemed clear that she wasn't going to speak to him again, he attempted a new way in.
So, he began, may I assume it is your mindfulness of the rift between your father and me that forces you to hold back any semblance of a smile?
Eliza puffed her way through a laugh, leaning as far forward as she could to distance herself from him.
But he pressed on. You see, I have been waiting for more than 2 years to tell you it pleased me wholeheartedly to receive your note after the ball, and I was sorely disappointed when you failed in your promise.
He said in a rush of sudden emotion that took both of them by surprise. Pardon me? What note? What promise? If I'd written a note to every gentleman I met, my days would be wasted complimenting clumsy men on their knack for walking the line or turning a reel. Must I remind you there is a war going on? I have more pressing things to do with my time.
Turning a reel? Is that what they're calling it these days?
Alex clucked his tongue against his cheek.
Forgive me if I seem old-fashioned, but I'd imagined I was the only one to whom you had written.
My word, Colonel Hamilton, you are besotted with yourself. Do you truly think you are such a fine dancer as all that? Would you be surprised if I said that I have but the dimmest recollection of that evening? Frankly, sir, of your time in my parents' house, I remember your affront to my father better than anything that passed between us.
Ah, miss, you cut me to the core.
I find it hard to believe that a woman's free speech could so unnerve you. For a man of war, you are easily shocked.
It is not your speech that shocks me. It is the actions to which it refers, and the apparently trifling regard with which you consider them.
Your dance maneuvers, Eliza laughed.
You cannot seriously think we were to dance in the hayloft.
I beg your pardon, Colonel Hamilton. I must confess myself unimpressed by any other aspect of your character other than your grace on the dance floor.
Alex shook his head, flabbergasted.
He yanked off a glove and reached into his inner pocket to pull out one of his most prized possessions.
"Do you profess ignorance of this?"
Eliza turned and regarded the square of wrinkled cloth in Alex's hand. "A somewhat soiled pocket handkerchief.
I have not washed it for more than 2 years," he said, affronted.
"That would explain the dirt."
"Miss Schuyler, are you asking me to believe you have no memory of my giving this very handkerchief to you?"
Alex could see only the profile of Eliza's face, but it seemed clear she was mystified. Suddenly, a fresh detail from that night popped into her mind. "Oh, yes, I surrender," she parroted. "As I recall, Angelica and Peggy and I routed you in the parlor where you were trying to impress Miss Tambling Goggin and Miss Van Leeuwenwort with your military prowess. I had completely forgotten about it until just now."
"So you are saying, then, that you have no memory of returning this handkerchief to me later that evening with a note?"
"Did I?" Eliza shrugged. "Well, that was awfully kind of me, wasn't it? Although, given its rather sorry state, I can see why I was so eager to be rid of it." Alex was doubly confused. Could it be that Eliza Schuyler, the most sensible of the Schuyler sisters, the one who was said to care more about the revolutionary cause than dresses or even books, was so feather-headed that she had no memory of a romantic missive she had sent? It was inconceivable.
"You must forgive me, Miss Schuyler," Alex said, his breath escaping in puffs in the frigid air. "Although I knew you were no shrinking violet, I still thought your sensibility was less jaded than this."
"Oh, good heavens, Colonel Hamilton, it's just a handkerchief."
"Indeed, it is not just a handkerchief. It is the very foundation of the male-female connection."
"Once again, Colonel Hamilton, I must beseech you not to take our present physical proximity as an excuse for licentiousness. Do not assume that it is anything other than necessity alone that has caused me to compromise my physical boundaries in this manner."
"Oh," Alex said dryly, "and I suppose you did not send me a note with the handkerchief that said you would meet me in the hayloft."
Hector stopped in his tracks to snort, blowing hard enough to make Eliza lift her chin and laugh. "Meet you in the hayloft? I beg your pardon, Colonel, but even your loyal horse finds this a bit ridiculous."
"Miss Schuyler, do not play the innocent with me. Though society may think you a girl consumed with nothing more than patriotic fervor, not even you could convince anyone that you are quite as brainless as you pretend."
"My dear Colonel, I do not know what is causing these wild insinuations, but I assure you they are as unwelcome as they are preposterous. If anything in my actions misled you to believe otherwise, I am both mortified and unapologetic."
"Misled?" Alex couldn't help himself. "Far from it. It was you who never showed up, after promising to meet me for a midnight assignation."
Eliza gasped. She turned around in the saddle, mere inches separating her from her accuser. "As God is my witness, sir, there was never a note from my hand to yours." Alex could see the truth as plain as the soft moonlight on her face. Eliza turned her back to him and slumped over the saddle.
In that moment, Alex felt 2 years of expectation slip away onto the cold road to Morristown. In the past 2 years, he had started to write but then discarded a number of letters addressed to this very maiden. He had stayed his hand for fear of sending the wrong message. What to write, after all, to a lady who sent midnight missives? He worried about being too presumptuous a lover, and instead had waited patiently for the right time to make her acquaintance once more, and had been champing at the bit when he'd heard she was to join her relatives in Morristown. But alas and alack, of course it hadn't been Eliza who had sent him the note. She was made of sturdier stuff than that. Someone else had sent his handkerchief back to him. Someone had been playing a trick on him, a trick that happened to be at her expense. But who could have done it? A memory came to him, of John Church swabbing Peterson's pink face with Alex's handkerchief, and Peterson snatching it up and pocketing it. Eliza seemed to have come to the same conclusion that he had been pranked, and badly. "Peterson," she said. "It must have been Peterson who sent the note. You see, Colonel, I'd lent your handkerchief to Angelica to wipe a stain off her dress, and when you were arguing, she handed it to Mr. Church, who
gave it to Peterson, and the man decided to return it to its owner."
Alex shook his head.
"Ill-minded mischief. And one I was a fool to fall for. I do apologize, Miss Schuyler."
"It was Peterson for certain," said Eliza.
"I have half a mind to go straight back to Albany and confront the man," said Alex grimly.
Eliza spoke in a dull whisper. "I do not know which is more offensive to me, that you think me capable of such an action, or that you find this an attractive feature."
"Miss Schuyler, please," Alex stammered. "I am undone. I genuinely thought the note was from your hand. That is to say, I would never think you, of all girls, capable of such..."
"And yet you did," Eliza said. "And not only that, you used it as an excuse to extend your flirtation with me. I am appalled."
"I assure you the appellation is all mine."
Alex banged a fist against his forehead, nearly knocking himself off the back of the horse. "Appellation? On top of everything else, he suddenly seemed to have forgotten how the English language worked." "If you please, Colonel, I would prefer if you did not speak for the rest of our journey." Eliza sat tall in the saddle, her back stiff as a board. "Were circumstances less unwelcoming, I would run for safety, but given that I am, for all intents and purposes, your prisoner, I am forced to remain in such repulsive proximity to you until we reach our destination. But for God's sake, please, cease speaking, or I really will throw you from this horse." Alex opened his mouth, thought better of it, and closed it. There was nothing to say to make the situation any better. He could only make it worse. Alexander Hamilton, widely reputed to be the most eloquent man in the United States of America, had, for the first time in his life, been rendered speechless. 10. Lean In to Me. Near the Cochran residence, Morristown, New Jersey, February 1780. The moon slipped under a blanket of clouds as the first snowflakes landed on Hector's shoulders. It had taken the big bay a mile or so to get used to the current arrangement on his back. While a war horse is able to withstand the roar of cannon fire without flinching, tolerating the tickle and swish of petticoats behind any horse's head is something altogether different. This brave gelding could neither see them nor shake off their bothersome lacy itch. But he quickly came to trust that the lightweight human perched on his back had the sort of skilled hands he could put up with. Eliza reached out and patted the bay's strong neck.
Walk on, Hector.
A mile or so back, the young colonel had pointed out final directions to the encampment before lapsing once more into an abashed silence. Thankfully, it wouldn't be long before this nightmare was behind her. The soft clip-clop of Hector's hooves beat quarter time to the racing march of her thoughts. It riled her to think about how Alex had accused her of the basest harlotry. The absolute cheek of the man. To think she of all people would have acted in such a way. To think he had believed her the type of girl who would send a boy notes outside of an approved courtship, with a tryst in a hayloft of all places. And yet the memory of taking his handkerchief was clearer now. The saucy way she, Angelica, and Peggy had cut the legs out from under the young aide-de-camp. That is, secretary, who was busy putting on airs in front of a posse of second-rate society girls, who were only flirting with him because they had neither fortune nor beauty enough to attract a more prestigious suitor. It was easy to see how her words could be misconstrued as flirting, pretending to cut down a boy to test his mettle. She had even felt the same thrill she got when she flirted with other boys. So maybe she had been flirting with him. Still, that gave him no right to make such gross presumptions about her. But he said there had been a note that he believed was from her hand. So they weren't really presumptions, were they? He seemed quite disappointed that she had not met this assignation, until he realized his mistake. It was bewildering. Eliza knew that she should think less of Alex for this, and assume him to be the sham of a gentleman that her mother claimed he was. But Eliza had met true roués before. Men who pretended to be respectable in public, and then indulged in the most repulsive behaviors in private. Alex hadn't behaved like a man who was removing a mask, or like he was trying to entice Eliza into something illicit or nefarious. No, his behavior seemed natural. Grateful, even, as if she had given him a rare but not unusual gift. An exquisitely wrought charcoal sketch, say, or the first crocus of spring. Still, Eliza couldn't let it go. The fury she felt was not near enough protection from the horrid cold. Although the realization that for 2 years he'd kept the handkerchief she'd once stuffed into her bodice had a peculiarly warming effect of its own. But this was still February in New Jersey. An uncontrollable shiver raced down her spine, shaking her from her reverie. The nice thing about anger was that it distracted you from the cold. But it didn't actually make you any warmer. And now Eliza's teeth began to chatter. She grabbed a hunk of Hector's thick black mane, hoping to find some warmth there, and didn't let go. Her body ached with fatigue from the cold, and she wasn't sure how long she could hold her seat. "You're shaking," he whispered. "Lean into me and let me take the reins from here." Eliza had no willfulness left in her. The cold had stripped it away. She closed her eyes and let go of the reins, melting into the warmth of his chest and shoulders as they closed in around her. In a feverish, dreamlike state, she was suddenly at home again in the warmth of her family's parlor. The young colonel was there, twirling her in his arms as he turned a reel with a graceful step. His hand on the small of her back and his breath against her neck made her feel as if she were floating in time and space. She had once found a young lady's delight in his arms. Now the closeness of the man hemmed in behind her brought solid comfort. The steady clip-clop of horse hooves and the mournful hoot of an owl lulled her toward a deeper calm. And somehow, she slept. Later, in the arms of the man she had told never to speak to her again, Eliza opened her eyes and looked into his face. "But how could it be that you were on the road today just as we approached?" "Shh," Alex whispered. "Shh." It won't be long before we'll have you sitting in front of a fire with a hot bowl of broth. For the moment, just lean back, close your eyes, and let Hector do his job.
Yes, yes. That sounds fine.